This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up on today's show, we'll get a movie review and some Oscar predictions just in time for today's big Oscar showing. But we are going to start, as we are always doing during this pandemic, as we check in with news director Dave Thompson for the latest news.
The 2021 North Dakota legislative session is lasting into this week. Legislative leaders had hoped to be adjourned by Friday, but Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner of Dickinson says there are still some agreements to be reached on a number of large budget bills.
But there are a lot of budget bills that we are just so close to getting solved and moving forward in an agreement. So I'm just hoping that next week we can move quickly and be done by Tuesday night or Wednesday. I can't give you a firm date anymore because I expected these bills to be out and on the table 2 days ago, and we're just getting them. So anyway, that kind of holds us up.
The last bill of the season is usually the budget bill for the state's Office of Management and Budget, which also acts as a catch-all bill. Warder says once you see the OMB Conference Committee, that will mean adjournment is on the horizon. The House has approved a bill to change the pension plan for public employees. It would affect people hired after January 1st, 2023. Right now, it's a defined benefit plan. The bill would make it a defined contribution plan. The current system has an unfunded liability of $1.4 billion. The proposal would put money toward the current plan to pay that down. Supporters say people who are on the defined benefit plan would have an option to convert to a defined contribution plan, but that would not be mandated. Fargo Democratic Representative Pamela Anderson says having a defined benefit plan is one of the things that attracts people to government jobs.
So now we're going to tell the new employees that, which will be younger ones, obviously, don't expect much in raises, 0 to 2% a year. Yeah, we really aren't even going to catch up with inflation. We do pay your health insurance, but we got a so-so retirement plan.
But supporters of the change say not many employers have a defined benefit plan. Bismarck Republican Representative George Kaiser.
I have yet to find a business other than the healthcare facilities for physicians that have a defined benefit program left today. They simply can't afford it.
The bill passed 76-16 and will now be considered by the state Senate, and it will likely be worked out in a conference committee. If you've done any home improvement projects or visited your local lumberyard recently, you might have noticed a sharp increase in the price of building materials.
For instance, the National Association of Home Builders sent a letter to the federal government in which they said that lumber prices have nearly tripled, and OSB prices are up more than 250% since last spring.
David Reed is president-elect for the Fargo-Moorhead Home Builders Association. He's owner of the company Radiant Homes. He says the increased cost of lumber and sheet goods has added an average of $24,000 to the cost of a newly constructed home since last April. Reed said it all goes back to lumber mills and the COVID-19 pandemic. For Main Street Weekend, I'm Dave Thompson.
Poems for the Moment. North Dakota poets reacting to this moment we're in.
Masks. Believe me, it is much better to hide. I only wear it to protect you from what I may possess.
Did she wear a mask? I wear one made of dragonfly print. The dragonfly, a protector during wars, a symbol of rebirth, hope, renewal.
And then in the same hour, North Dakota high school students performing poetry from Poetry Out Loud.
Peoples bore me. Literature bores me, especially great literature.
Today at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And here is a novel that is setting fire to the literary world right now. It is called Firekeeper's Daughter. And the author, Angeline Booley, is someone who wanted to create a native Nancy Drew. And she does so in the character Donis Firekeeper, a determined teen who reluctantly joins forces with the FBI to investigate a pervasive meth ring on reservations and in hockey towns. Angeline Booley is an enrolled member of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. She is a former director of Indian education at the U.S. Department of Education. Firekeeper's Daughter is her first novel. Angeline, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I can't imagine already what it's like to put a book out into this world. But then you add on to it, you're putting a book out into this world that NPR calls an absolute powerhouse of a novel that makes the Reese Witherspoon YA Young Adults Book Club pick, that the Higher Ground production company started by the Obamas have picked up and optioned into a Netflix series when it comes to a first book. So first of all, just pause for a second. When did it feel real that you put this out there?
It is so surreal that I think I actually had to see it in a bookstore to really believe it. Even when they sent the box, a box to me of the finished book, and it was my first time holding it in my hands, that was pretty special. And my parents were at my house, so they got to see it. But really, I think it took seeing it in a book on a bookshelf that, yeah.
As I understand, the germ of this book planted itself, the seed of this book planted itself in your head when you were a teenager. It sat there for a couple decades, and then you spent another decade or so writing it.
Yes, that's exactly what happened.
Well, let's go back to that teenage self and then the teenage protagonist that's in this book, Donis. And I'm wondering, how did you put yourself in that mindset of still remembering what it's like to be a woman in this coming of age, tender part of life?
I felt things so strongly that I think I just was scarred, for lack of a better word, by all the things that, you know, happened when I was younger, and the things that really made an impression on me. And then seeing, you know, I have three kids, and my boys were teenagers when I started writing. My daughter was a preteen, and she's now a senior in college. And then I've always worked in Indian education. So I've always been around teens, and just seeing the similar things that my students have gone through and my children, I think that's why I felt so connected still to things that happened to me when I was much younger.
It's so important in the book that your people, the Anishinaabe, and particularly the women, are called upon to solve their own problems. There's a hilarious line in the book where you say that one of the worst things that white people can do is say, hey, I'm here from the federal government and I'm here to help, or just, you know, I'm here to help, and just have no concept of the loaded language that comes into a phrase like, I'm here to help. So just that thread of wanting young women in particular to have that sense of agency, why was that so important to you?
Because young people do have so much agency, and, you know, and she's so close to her Aunt Teddy, and so, you know, she's been raised with Teddy's comments, you know, and observations about things, how things work, and these are not secrets in the Native community. The FBI has a and the, you know, other federal agencies don't have a good reputation with right. tribes for the most part.
The title, Firekeeper's Daughter. I want to start with Firekeeper. It's both a last name, but really a calling. What does it mean among the Anishinaabe people to be a firekeeper?
Well, firekeepers are men who have been taught how to strike ceremonial fires, and they're tasked with maintaining that fire for the duration of the event, whether it's a funeral or a fasting camp. And they also maintain the protocols because those are special fires, and you know, you don't gossip or drink or, you know, speak badly about someone. You only talk about good things, sharing stories. That fire is serving a purpose for what it's doing. So, and my father is a firekeeper. So I've spent many times, you know, with him on the fire and just listening to all these stories that, you know, he might not, he never, things that he didn't teach me when I was younger, but now when he's sitting at the fire, he just is so full of all of these stories. And firekeeper, it was multiple layers of why I, you know, picked that. So there's that, you know, that role in the community. And then also one of our teachings about firekeeper's daughter, she's the daughter of the first firekeeper, and she starts each day by lifting the sun with a song. And so that really was to, I really liked that teaching and the way that Donis would react to it, because it's all about what is your duty and what is your role in your community. And that's something that, you know, Donis goes through moments where she doesn't want this responsibility. She doesn't want to be in the position that she's in of, you know, helping the FBI with this investigation. And so that was another powerful way to have the story be aligned with our cultural teachings.
With a title like Firekeeper's Daughter, there's an exploration here of what it means to be named after sort of a male line before you start to come in to your own.
Yeah, and you know, her identity as an Ojibwe young woman, she thinks of herself in all these different roles, you know, the daughter of, the niece of,
right?
And then she's, you know, adds that extra name to her prayer every morning when she introduces herself to be sure that Creator knows who she is. And at some point she recognizes that she's the one who wasn't sure about things, that Creator's always known who she is.
But there is that importance, that stepping into the part of it that is writing your own story, even if Creator already knew where you were going.
Mm-hmm.
How important were rituals to you growing up?
I think I took them for granted because my dad is Ojibwe, and he would do things a certain way, and we just thought that, for example, we just thought everyone puts loose tobacco in a casket when a loved one, you know, at a loved one's funeral. And then finding out, oh, that's putting tobacco in for their journey, and this is what we do. And so I think I grew up with different teachings that were never explained, but they were just part of how we lived. And then as an adult or later, just finding out what the teachings behind that.
One thing that you had to teach yourself, this would not at all be a cultural tradition or a ritual or something that a person should learn how to do. You learned how to make meth to write this book.
Yes, I did.
Wow.
I was, yes, able to, and I learned by from the state police. That's not the normal book research that gets done.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, I mean, how did you even present this? Because this was something that law enforcement was going to do, and they need to learn how so that they can identify if there's meth happening in their community. But I'm just wondering the reaction of, oh, I'm writing a book about meth. Can I learn this?
I was on some committee in Sault Ste. Marie, and there was a professor there from the university, and he's a former law enforcement officer. And so he had really good connections at the State Police Academy. And we had talked about my book. He was really interested in it. And then he said, if you're willing, I think that I could set something up where you could attend one of these classes. It was incredible just learning the different methods of making meth and then how to spot clandestine meth labs, which, you know, meth is especially prevalent in rural areas. So that's the Upper Peninsula. And just finding out all the different places that law enforcement has found meth lab operations going on. Yeah, it's pretty startling.
Throughout the book, there is this concept of the difference between good medicine and bad medicine. Meth very much, of course, falls into this category of bad medicine. What do you mean when you say good medicine versus bad medicine?
Good medicine is for healing, and bad medicine is the opposite side of that coin. Mm-hmm. You know, we learn that medicines are serious business and you don't mess around with things that you don't know all about. I needed to be really careful about how I talked about bad medicine because mm-hmm. that is a real thing in my community. You know, there's a lot of things that aren't meant for outside of the community.
Mm. Am I correct in also reading that there is an intention and a purpose behind something that might sometimes be a good medicine, but if the intention is wrong, it can be a bad medicine?
Yeah, I think that is possible, that the intention of how you are going to use that medicine can transform, you know, and those are just teachings that I have gotten about, you know, about our plants and our medicines. So,
yeah. Well, in the book, Donis, still a teenager, is very well versed in plant medicine of the Anishinaabe people near the Great Lakes area of this land. At that age, when you were that age, were you aware of these medicines, or is this something you had to learn as an adult?
No, I wasn't very familiar with them, but my grandma would. Again, like my dad, my grandma would just do certain things. And I guess mm-hmm. I just thought that everybody's grandma maybe boiled rags with some different plants mm-hmm. and wrap it around your neck to keep so that you wouldn't catch cold. But it was so stinky that people stayed away from you. So maybe you weren't catching cold because you weren't in there. Yeah. You know, I think that when you just grow up seeing things done and it's normal to you mm-hmm. that it's just a part of your life, and then maybe when you're older you realize, oh, I was learning about some very old medicines by my grandmother and I didn't realize it at the time.
So how are you teaching these to your own offspring and to the next generation?
Well, I own the family land on Sugar Island mm-hmm. and there's that connection with the land, and then really it's seeing what my kids are interested in and which of my cousins or nieces or family members are interested in learning more about it, and you know, those are the ones that I'll spend more time telling stories or talking about things.
We're visiting today with Angeline Bouly. She is the author of Fire Keeper's Daughter. This is her first novel. And Angeline, let's Let's talk a little bit more about the actual structure of the book. We talked about how you had this first idea when you were a teenager, and you grew up reading and loving a character like Nancy Drew, but Nancy Drew, aside from being a girl, wasn't looking like you, didn't have the same cultural references and backgrounds that you might have. So just why or where did the idea come from that you were going to give such a young woman so much power and responsibility?
Well, I learned about the hero's journey when my kids were younger. And I'm not sure where it exactly started, but my kids and I were talking about the similarities between Star Wars and Harry Potter. And so I heard about something called the Hero's Journey. So I did a little bit of research, and then I thought it would be kind of a fun activity for one of my sons and my daughter to talk about, plot out like what were similar, what things were similar. And then I started doing more reading about the hero's journey. And I thought, well, we have our heroes, or we have our hero stories, and, you know, different ways that cultural teachings are passed down through story. And then I thought, what if it was a hero's journey, but told from an Ojibwe young woman's perspective? What if she was the hero in a story? Also, I saw, I'm a visual person, and so I saw this circle that had the hero's journey plotted out, kind of like numbers on a clock. So you'd have like, this is when this happens, and then this, and this, and this. And I happened to see it, and then right after that, I saw the visual depiction of the Ojibwe medicine wheel, and that is split into four sections, and it covers like the four directions, four colors, the four different teachings that we get through that medicine wheel. And I thought, wait, what if the hero's journey and the medicine wheel teachings, what if I overlaid that and her journey followed that those medicine wheel teachings? And that felt like a eureka moment. And that was when I really thought, okay, there's something to this, of telling this story in this indigenous way.
Yeah, the book is in four main sections. There's the journey to the east, the south, the west, the north, dividing the story into those four cardinal directions. What is the significance of that?
Well, putting it in cultural terms and book terms, a lot of books are done in a three-act structure, mm-hmm. but, you know, with the medicine wheel and our teachings, then four is a very strong number. Part one, the eastern direction, it's, you know, a time of new beginnings. And so that was really laying out the world building for the reader to be immersed in Donis's experience. And then, you know, it takes you through the inciting incident and her choosing to be part of the investigation. And so that's like stepping from the known world into the unknown. Mm-hmm. And then that southern direction is really a time for wandering and wondering. And so that's where her identity as a confidential informant, or as she calls it, a secret squirrel, you know, and all of these fun and games of her learning things and either failing or succeeding at different tasks that she's trying to do. And then the western direction, the stakes really get much, you know, are much higher, coming to a climax, and that finding out the truth of what is going on. And then, of course, that northern direction symbolizes that wisdom when we're in that part of our journey. To know truth is to know that there's so many things that can't be known, and that acceptance of it. And so that really felt right for the course of the story.
Yeah, she's so wise in that journey in the North. I mean, she's clever and she's smart throughout the whole book. But by the time she gets to her journey in the North, she really has become wise and still so, so young. And I'm thinking in particular, and I don't want to give away any major plot points, but of course, this is a YA novel. There is a little bit of a love interest. We got to keep the teenagers interested on multiple levels here. And then you work into how a young woman can approach a relationship and be with somebody, but first she has to be her own person.
Yes, yes. I think, you know, it's so important for women to have healthy boundaries and to love themselves. And so I think that, you know, we hope that, I think the earlier you learn that, the better off you are, because there are some really painful lessons. If you don't learn that, it keeps getting repeated over and over in terms of unhealthy dating or relationship patterns. To see Donis get that and understand it and put that into practice, I felt that was such a good thing to show. That you can love someone and make choices that honor both of you.
It's one of the most difficult parts of parenting, in my opinion, is watching your children make mistakes and you're just sitting there screaming, but I've already made this mistake. I can save you from this pain. Do you feel that way as, you know, the parent, if you will, of the characters that you're creating, making some horrendous mistakes?
Oh, I do. And, you know, I worked on the book for 10 years. So I have draft versions where Donis is perfect and makes every right decision and frankly was a boring character. And I have other ones where, you know, it just the story has evolved so much. But I remember one time I was trying to write a draft where Donis does not like Jamie and continues to not like him throughout the story. And it just, those two crazy kids just kept fighting their way back to each other. It was like, I tried to make them steer right, but they kept going left. And I remember commenting to someone, I was like, they're making such poor decisions. I just can't even handle it. And and the person was a writer also, and they said, those are my best kind of characters.
I never get tired of hearing an author basically say that they're not the ones in control of what the characters are doing.
I think, you know, when you know your characters so well and you trust that maybe the story is bigger than you, that when I'm writing a scene and I think the scene is going to go in one direction and then some idea just takes hold and I just get out of my way and I just type whatever is coming to me because I feel there's so much value in that, that like you're honoring that wherever these ideas are coming from, I will just type away. Just keep them coming.
You have expressed sometimes you're frustrated at their decisions. Are you ever surprised by what your characters are doing?
Yeah. Yeah. Because over the 10 years and the various drafts, there have been various villains. I would say that there's probably a draft out there with each character in the book a villain at one point. And so it just, there was one character that I was convinced was a villain. Oh. And then he revealed to me that he wasn't. And so that was really interesting because that was probably one of the last major changes I made in my last draft. Wow. And to me, it added such a layer to the story. I'm just so happy about it.
So in addition to your characters telling you where they want the book to go, you also have to work in real life with editors. What's your process for working with an editor? I'm always wondering, is it, okay, I've done all I can do, it's your turn, or are you apprehensive just saying, like, I put myself onto these pages, please be gentle?
So I was fortunate that there were a number of editors that were interested in their publishing house getting the rights to the book. And so I had conversations with every editor that was interested, and that helped me to see like what their vision was and what my vision was for the story. For example, if a publisher didn't feel that my story would be a lead title for the season that they were thinking of, that didn't interest me. And so really it was the publisher, the editor that was most in sync with where I saw my book going and could bring something to that process that I couldn't achieve without their help. And so it was respecting that. And that's what my editor did. So in that first phone call that I ever had with her, she spoke so quickly. And she told me, you know, you're introducing too many secondary characters in your first act, and all of these secondary characters are going to be so much more memorable as suspects. And that was such a light bulb moment of, oh my God, she just figured out why I am struggling so hard with act one. And so it was, you know, very much looking forward to that type of input. And, you know, there were things that maybe she would say, would you consider this? And I would say, oh, absolutely not. And then we would go back and forth and talking about it. And then I would kind of simmer and think about it. And then I would realize she's right, but I'm right too. But how can I accomplish what I wanted to do with this scene, but still take into account the very valid points that she's bringing up? And that made the story so much stronger, because I really had to think through, why is this incident in the book? And how could I be more responsible about it? Is there a different place in the story where this could happen, where it would have more impact than if it's clustered in with the climax and all these other things, and it doesn't give the reader a chance to breathe? And so that's a really great example of how working with the right editor, it just becomes this really engaging dialogue where you explore different ways of telling the story and what your purpose, what your intent is, and how their expertise can help you take that story somewhere even better than what you could have imagined.
There is so much pain in this book. There's meth addiction, there's rape, there is severe racism, but it's almost like that becomes just the surface level. That's the tip of the iceberg in this book. Even deeper, at least to my reading, is the strength and the love and the cultural ties within this book. Was that a conscious choice on your part, or is it just a natural consequence of the deep love and connection that you have to your culture?
It's both. You know, one of the mantras I had was, I'm writing about trauma, but I'm not writing a tragedy. And so I wasn't writing, I've heard some authors say trauma porn or mining your community's trauma. And so I really wanted to balance that with all the wonderful things about my community. And yes, there are some awful things that have happened. And we also have some wonderful healing ways that also have been passed down through generations. And so if you only hear about the trauma, you're not getting the full story about my community or my family.
I'm not entirely sure how to ask this next question, but so I'm thinking of this example of one of the first female pilots became a pilot much earlier than you maybe would expect based on, you know, the number of male to female pilots there are right now. But then it just, she faced tremendous sexism and it didn't work out for her to stay as a pilot. And then it was decades before airlines would hire another woman. And there's always so much pressure when you are breaking out of the mold of what society, you know, wants people to be, and we like to put them in boxes and particularly marginalized groups, and being both a woman and from an indigenous perspective, the dominant culture likes to keep both of these people groups from reaching their full potential. Did you feel sort of extra pressure that you were going to have to really put something great out there, or else it's going to be one of those things where it's like, oh, well, that's, you know, just another book by just another, you know, whatever.
Right. Honestly, yes. I have put pressure on myself. It's not any pressure that I've gotten from, you know, certainly my publisher or my agent. In fact, my agent will talk me down when I'm starting to spiral. But in the lead up to the book publication date, I was nervous because when you're from a marginalized community, it's kind of like, okay, when there's a movie that's directed by a person of color, it's like they get one shot to be excellent. And if they don't meet expectations or the studio doesn't make a profit, well, then it's going to be a very long time before that studio takes a chance on another person of color as a director or, you know, in that role. And I worried that publishing might be like that as well, just because there are so few stories about Native Americans by Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And so I felt a responsibility to own voices, that I didn't want to do any damage, that if my book didn't perform well, I worried what that might mean for other Native authors. And that is a shame to feel that, but that is my reality. At the risk of being controversial, mediocre white male directors always get multiple chances to be mediocre, but a person of color, a woman, we get less chances, and that is the current reality.
Are you able to have this kind of creative control as this book takes on its next life? It's being made into a Netflix series picked up by the production company Higher Ground, run by one Michelle and former President Barack Obama. First of all, congratulations. That's an incredible journey for a first-time novelist. But now, as it goes into this next phase, you talked about the importance of working with your editor and you being able to still say, no, I'm not comfortable with the book going this direction. Will you have that same kind of creative control as it moves on?
In a word, no. Oh. But because the film options, you have to think of it like fan fiction, that when you sign that contract for the film rights, you are handing over your baby, your book baby, to other people to shape and mold and to have their creative voice on your project. The time when an author has that negotiating power is when you're in conversations with the different production companies that are interested in optioning your book. And so I would ask questions about, or I would make it clear that a very strong priority of mine was to have Native creative talent, not just in front of the camera, but behind the camera, in the writer's room. Like, it was very important for me that own voices meant more than just my written words. It was throughout the production of this book to a series. And so, you know, there were production companies that, let's say, they weren't in sync with that, or they had a different vision, or it was clear they hadn't done their homework about it, and I knew I would be doing Indians 101 with them. And that was so not the case with Higher Ground Productions. They immediately, they got it. They had done their homework. They knew of people in the industry that they wanted to work with. It was really exciting. And that's what is so, I mean, yes, of course, the Obamas, yes. But that vision needed to be, they needed to get that. And they completely, Higher Ground Productions, I cannot speak any more highly than they are the best partners in the world.
Do you know when will we get to watch this?
I don't know much about the film and streaming worlds, but I do know that things take a lot longer than I would ever imagine. So really, I honestly don't know.
Well, luckily, we do know you have a lot of patience if it took a few decades to get this book out there.
Yes.
Will we have to wait a few more decades for your next book?
No, no, you will not. I recognize that I do not have the luxury of 10 years to, but I'm hoping that I've learned a lot about writing the first one, that the second one goes smoother. So yeah, my book deal with Macmillan was for 2 books. And so I do have a book 2 that I'm working on.
Can you give us any teasers?
Yes. If book 1 is Indigenous Nancy Drew, book 2 is Indigenous Lara Croft.
Oh.
Instead of raiding tombs, the main character is reclaiming ancestral remains and cultural items from museums to bring them back home. And one of her heists goes very badly.
All right. Well, I am going to pre-order that right now. Angeline, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure talking with you.
And that was author Angeline Booley. Her first novel is Firekeeper's Daughter. She was selected as an emerging young adult writer in 2019 and was chosen to attend the 2019 Tin House YA Writers Workshop. She is a former director of Indian education at the U.S. Department of Education. And she is an enrolled member of the Sault Ste. Marie Tribe of Chippewa Indians. You can find out more about her at angelinebooley.com. The book is widely available.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
All right, cue the fanfare. That means it is time for another movie review from our movie critic, Matt Olean. And Matt, this is one of those films where it doesn't really matter what any critic might say. People are going to go see it, right?
I call it critic-proof. That's a critic-proof movie. And this is now becoming kind of a franchise. Godzilla versus Kong. Okay. And we go back to the Godzilla reboot, I think 6 years ago. Then we had Skull Island with Brie Larson. I think that was 3 years ago. And so those all kind of feed into this, which is now Godzilla versus Kong. The title says all everything you need to know. They're going to fight. They're going to throw down. They're going to get after it in this movie. So it's basically an old-time monster movie from the 50s where Godzilla unprovoked, seemingly, attacks this building in Florida, which is actually a company that is up to nefarious activities. Demian Bashir, fine Mexican actor, plays kind of the head of this corporation that, yeah, they seem like they're good, but they're really up to no good. As is often the case in these monster movies, somebody's up to no good, and it's provoked Godzilla.
Yeah.
So, of course, the scientists are called in, as they always are in these movies, and they have to kind of do battle with the Army and the Navy. You know, we want to see if we can figure out what's going on, and then they bring Kong into it, and, you know, it's just crazy. But, you know, for right now, as we hopefully near the end of this pandemic, this is exactly what the box office needed. This
escapism.
We might look back, Ashley, and say this movie saved theaters because it grossed $40 million its first weekend, which is crazy considering, you know, they're still spacing people out of the theaters. When I go, you have to wear the mask. And it's I mean, it was crowded when I went, but it was not – it wasn't a typical Friday night opening pre-pandemic where you couldn't get a seat to a movie like this. So taken on its own terms, it's fine. It's CGI heavy. There's some good actors, Rebecca Hall, Alexander Skarsgård, Millie Bobby Brown – plays the daughter of a scientist, and she is kind of a stowaway situation. There's a journey to the Earth's core. There's all kinds of stuff going on scientifically that make absolutely no sense, but that's okay because we're dealing with a giant lizard and a giant ape as well. So, but this is escapism fantasy movie. For what it is, it's fine. I would not say it's a great monster movie. But I think for 2021, this is exactly what theaters needed. It's exactly what the box office needed. Mm-hmm. Go to a mindless monster movie where CGI monsters are fighting each other and scientists are trying to figure out how to save the world, how to save cities, how to get Godzilla to stand down, how to get Kong and Godzilla to kind of fight each other and then maybe get along later. There's all kinds of little things going on. And there's always evildoers run amok, too. Demian Bashir, as I mentioned, is the head of this massive corporation that is up to no good and might have something to do with what's going on. So if you just want some mindless entertainment, this is the movie to go see.
Well, that mindless entertainment, you know, movies in this vein, they tend to be more thought of, at least after the fact, as known for their technical achievements. Mm-hmm. Does this film kind of push the boundaries of our technical achievements?
Yeah, I would say the CGI is good. It's, you know, I can tell what's going on because I know how these movies are made, mm-hmm. and I know exactly how they're edited together and, you know, things are done in post-production. So I still like the old-time King Kong from the 30s. Ray Harryhausen was a genius. He did Jason and the Argonauts and things like that. And it's kind of that stop-motion animation monster stuff that looked so good on the screen. And, you know, for me, nothing will ever quite top that. You know, skeletons coming out of the ground and Jason and the Argonauts and sword fighting to stop-motion animation. So the CGI is what it is. It's cost-effective. It's the way to do movies like this. You know, some of the actors are good. I really like Rebecca Hall. She's one of the scientists who knows a few things. But really, the scene-stealing performance is Kaylee Hoddle as Gia, and she is this little girl who does not speak, but she sort of communicates with Kong. It's kind of this, you know, just like with the original King Kong, you know, Fay Wray was able to calm the beast down, mm-hmm. and this little girl can kind of talk to Kong in sign language. Those scenes are actually pretty good. She's able to communicate with Kong, find out what he's thinking, find out what he wants to do. And she's really the linchpin in the whole movie.
Okay. In the last iteration of Godzilla versus Kong, there is what some would say a clear winner. Mm-hmm. Do we get that in this one? Are you going
to
say?
I can't say. Okay. You have to go see it.
Let me just say
there is a third party that joins the battle. A third.
Is it Wonder Woman?
No. This is. You'll have to go see what I'm talking about.
Of course,
but
she wouldn't be a monster.
There's quite a melee at the end. Let me just say that all heck breaks loose.
All right. Well, this film did get an Oscar. You know, it's not getting Best Picture, that kind of things. Back in the 1930s, this first version of it did get a technical achievement award. Who got that and why?
So you want the name of the person? Is it Marion C. Cooper? He directed it. He directed King Kong. Oh, mm-hmm. Ernest Schoedsack. Is that his name?
Fred Jackman,
that's right.
Sidney Saunders.
Okay. That's
who got it for their development and effective use of the translucent cellulose screen in composite photography.
Okay.
Really rolls off
for
the tongue.
For King Kong, 1933, right?
All right, yep. Well, and speaking of Oscars, we do have the first Oscars in a pandemic world. The last one, you know, narrowly escaped, and now what are your predictions for this Oscar season?
What a strange year. A lot of these films never appeared in a theater. It's very strange. You know, Trial of the Chicago 7, things like this, just they were not in theaters because the rules were bent for this year. So I think it'd be dumb to pick against Nomadland for Best Picture. It's won all the awards leading up to it. Chloe Zhao is probably going to win Best Director for Nomadland. I think when you get to the acting categories, Ashley, the supporting awards are easier to predict. Daniel Kaluuya has emerged as the front runner for supporting actor in Judas and the Black Messiah as Fred Hampton, so I believe he'll win. And in the Best Supporting Actress category, it now appears that Minari South Korean actress Yoon Jung-yoon has emerged as the favorite. She's won a lot of critics' awards. She won the BAFTA, and I do think she's going to win for the wonderful movie Minari. Now, where things get tricky, our lead actor, lead actress. No one has been able to break away from the pack in the Best Actress category as kind of the clear frontrunner, the way Renee Zellweger did last year for Judy. Mm-hmm. It was thought for a long time that Carey Mulligan, it was her award to lose for Promising Young Woman. I think she should win. I think she will eke out a very, very close vote and win. The problem is Viola Davis won the SAG for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and she's great in it. And Frances McDormand won the BAFTA for Nomadland.
Mm-hmm. And she's already got two.
And she's got two, and Viola Davis has one. So the theory here, this is my theory, is Viola Davis and Andra Day in The United States versus Billie Holiday are both in kind of music biopics. And so that might split that vote a little bit. McDormand has two Oscars. And so I think Mulligan will win almost by default because it's a very showy performance. It's an interesting performance. It's a very good film. And keep in mind, there's a high volume of Academy voters that are British. And so that could help Carey Mulligan out as well. Best Actor, I'm starting to think this is going to be closer than I thought it was going to be. So Chadwick Boseman has passed away. Mm-hmm. And certainly he's great in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, but there's also a sentimental factor there to award him a posthumous Oscar. It's happened twice before, Heath Ledger and Peter Finch. But Anthony Hopkins just got the BAFTA. And again, there's a high degree of Academy voters that are British, and Hopkins is very well respected. I've seen all five Best Actor performances. I would vote for Anthony Hopkins. I think if Chadwick Boseman was alive, and I wish he was, Hopkins would win. But I think that the sentiment is toward Boseman to win this award. So I think it's going to be a very close award, but do not be surprised if Hopkins wins his second Best Actor Oscar because he's that good in The Father. It is a must-see performance that will break your heart. But if Boseman wins, that's fine as well.
All right. Well, we will tune in this Sunday to see how those predictions mm-hmm. bear out. We've been to the movies with Matt Olien. That's it for this Sunday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow during our 3 o'clock time slot, we visit with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein for the latest installment of the Philosophical Currents segment as he and I dive into the Derek Chauvin trial. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.